Session number 11530, Rule 2.
Dr. Roy Tildesley, Rule 2. Yes, I was asking you about, you know, going into a unit of like...
Oh, yes,
people.
It was a tremendous relief. Oh, yes, it was... It's like going to a college or a university of like minds, you know. It was really quite educational. And one felt strengthened by the sheer numbers. I mean, we've got half a dozen blokes who felt the same, and you got thrown out of a hospital, you didn't feel too bad about it. I mean, we rather laughed at it in the end. I mean, because the six of us got thrown out, it wasn't... So, if that had been me, on my own, thrown out for my misdemeanour or something, or some what they thought of misdemeanour, or because of my views, I felt very vulnerable about it. But as a group, you feel very much more secure, I think.
Well, what did you think about the FAU when you went into it? You know, this would be before your experience in Germany.
Well, I'd read about it and knew what they're up to. I'd followed all their... I think I got their bulletins or something, even though I was on their waiting list, as it were. So I was interested in what they're getting up to and the projects they were developing, and was looking for an opening that I thought I could be useful in and enjoy.
Have they got much of a reputation by 1944, would you say, the organisation?
Well, they had to me. I mean, I thought they were marvellous, but I don't know how true it was, I don't know, but to me they seemed to be seeking to spread a bit of decency and light about the world in a very humble way, but doing it reasonably well, I thought.
Did you have to go to the training camp at Birmingham?
Oh, yes, went to that in, when was that? I've got the date of that. There's a picture of it, when was it? March 44, yes.
I suppose you would have been quite skilled, wouldn't you, medically?
Well, yes, I mean, I'd had office training, you see, so it's about 3 years and about 2 years of hospital training, so I was a mature student, you might say. So the first aid course was no problem to me and that sort of thing they did. And I didn't find any of their training difficult. And then later on, of course, after that training camp, I did 3 months down here in Bristol doing motor mechanics at Fayland, where a Mr. Tanner gave his house over to the FAU during the war, and Bob, his son, got drowned going out to the Far East in the FAU. Anyway, they ran a motor mechanics course there for 3 months, which I did as well. So my medical background plus motor mechanics, so I was pretty versatile. Of course, I had knowledge of German, which was quite useful when it came to Europe.
Did you go in on the understanding that you wanted to do relief work in Europe?
No. I just gambled that the events would move that way and that there'd be openings.
When did you hear that there was an opening?
I can't remember that.
I suppose
D-Day. Yes, with D-Day, I suppose, is the thought. Well, everybody thought, well, there's bound to be things happening now. I think that's really what it is. Yes, when I was at D-Day, I was in Bristol here in Fayland doing the motor mechanics training. So, June 44? Was it? Yes.
Did you get special training for relief work?
Yes, it was often. Not an intensive course, but it's often referred to, I think, in the general training. I think there was some talks on it. Really, by example, I think, just saying what was being happening elsewhere. And there was a few talks from seniors sometimes, just before we went abroad in Birmingham. There was a middle assembly depot or something it was called, where we hung around for a week or two and we got talks and got our kits and so on. Yes, I think we got some, as much as one can give about it, but it would be considered very poor by present-day standards, so, but today they go over the top, I think, don't they, with dotting every I, crossing every T and leaving no... really, a job creation for the lecturer, I think, really. Lots of modern trainings that...
Before we go into the relief work, I wondered how your financial situation was affected by leaving... The hospital, you know, the independent work you were doing.
Oh, well, that's virtually the same. I got, when I went to the hospital job, the secretary of the hospital, of course, they're all private in those days, just charity hospitals. He said, how much are you getting in civil service? I said, £2.10 a week. So you get the same here. So I got £2.10 a week. £2.50, I suppose, my today's money. And so I had that much, and I lived at home, so my mother took some of that, but had about, I suppose, 15 shillings pocket money, something like that, a week. And then the FAU, when I went to the FAU, you had members' assistance fund for those who had no income, and I hadn't. So I got my keep, and was it? I'm not sure what it was. David had a problem. 7 or 6 a week, was it? Something of that sort. And that was enough to go to the pictures, and I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, so I was never felt to. I mean, I was obviously liked more, but I never felt that hard. The main thing was travel, I suppose. If you wanted to go home or something of that sort, you couldn't, or you wanted to have a look around Liverpool or something, you'd have to plan it.
What was the situation regarding women in the FAU when you joined? You know, were you aware of women members?
Not really, no. No, there weren't. I'd met one or two, but I mean, there were. I'd not. In the hospital, I hadn't met any. I suspect there were one or two. Friends, there was one who talks German, wasn't there? A German woman who talks German. Whether she was a member or whether she was a. And that was a. She wrote a book, Heuter Abend. But there were, you know, several about, but they didn't seem to be doing the front, you know, pig bins and stoking up and all the front line stuff. They seemed to be specialists, I suppose, in some way or other. I think the situation changed as the war went on, but at that stage when I joined it, there weren't any women that I knew particularly. There were one or two at head, I think there were one or two in London, but I don't know anybody else. Maybe some in China, which I didn't know about. But I'm not sure.
So could I ask you now about your relief work abroad? You know, your journey over. Where, you know, where did you leave from and where did you go?
Oh, that's November 44, from Tilbury to Ostend.
That the usual. Been with a big convoy?
Yes, tank landing craft. We all drove our trucks on and lashed them down and wonder what was going to happen next, but the usual delays. As you know, war is very slow business, really. There's nothing much happening for days, often enough.
Is that what you found?
Oh, yes. Yes, I mean, you get the impression there's always action all the time. In fact, you're twiddling your thumb most of the time, aren't you? Or servicing things, getting things in place, or moving things about. But actually, war is all about. one of the few chaps put it. You build up so much stuff in one place, something's got to happen, otherwise it'll burst. You know, they ferry so many tanks to a certain place so that something's got to happen, you know. So there's a bit of that about it. Anyway, got to Ostend, and I think it was a convoy drove off. We didn't land in the water, we landed on a dock, which is rather nice. Drove off this pontoon sort of dock thing. And it was cold weather. I think we were all in convoy, about, I don't know, 12 or 20 trucks, something like that, with our very famous leader in front, General Gardner. You've heard of General, I suppose, or met him, of course, haven't you? And it was very icy, and we all slid into each other, which was rather a bad start. So we thought it was a bad omen. Anyway, no truck was completely off the road, but a few dents in most of the tracks, which is not a very interesting bit, but it amuses all. Well, rather worried is at the time, but it's amusing to talk about now. Anyway, finished up in Antwerp. That was our goal at that stage. I'm not sure we spent a night on the road or something of that sort, or two nights. But our job was supposed to be to rescue people from supplement the ambulance services in Antwerp who were being inundated with V1s and V2s. I think we're V1s, I'm not sure. We weren't there very long because it turned out that I think the V1s had been overrun, those launching sites, or the embassy was coping onto it. But anyway, we moved on from there down to the south somewhere. I think it was, I can't remember where, I think it was Sittard probably, or that direction, the south. And we were supposed to be dealing with refugees, and I think we spent a week or two, processing refugees who were being evacuated from other parts of Holland because of the armies moving about. Dutch refugees were coming through the lines, and we spent our time powdering them with DDT. As they stood there, they came into the rooms, and we stood there with some Dutch workers, powdering up the sleeves and up the trousers and down the tummies to stop the fear of lice and fleas and all the other things that might, typhus they might bring with them.
Would DDT have been about the only thing you could have used then?
I gather so, yes. I don't think there'd be anything else in those days. Still good stuff, but, you know, they worry about it having toxic effects, but, I mean, it's the one dose wouldn't do him any harm. But in the small print, somebody's going to suffer someday, I suppose. But in a war situation, it's a reasonable thing to do, I suppose. It's cost-effective and the only thing that was available.
Well, what was your immediate sort of impression of a war zone?
Very exciting. Lots going on. In the sense that, you know, you're in the news, as it were. There was the drama. You were in it. And after being stuck in England, just reading about it, it was quite, to a young person, it was quite exciting. Oddly enough, I didn't. Oh, I see. Well, nobody seemed to be unduly worried about the bombs, because most of us have been in London dealing with casualties and bombs in there, and so we felt we're experienced older people compared with the people in Antwerp.
Yes, it's interesting you're talking about the V1s and V2s in Antwerp area. Did the people suffer a lot from these, would you say? Was there a lot?
I don't really know. I don't think they're all that much damaged compared with the rest of what we'd seen in London. I don't know, because I wasn't involved with it very much. I did very little in Antwerp. I mean, it was the ambulance crews. We couldn't all go on the ambulance. There were two ambulances with each section, I think. And I think my job was something totally different. I can't remember what I did in Antwerp, quite honestly. I didn't go on the ambulances at that stage. I may have serviced them or something of that sort, but I didn't go on them to see the damage.
Were you all, was this feeling that people wanted to get into Germany, would you say, at that time?
Yes.
When the troops were advancing, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think everybody felt the war was inevitably going to end in the foreseeable future, and that Germany couldn't last forever. There was never any doubt in anybody's minds. I mean, the military particularly, that it was a matter of time, but it was nasty business beforehand. And it was very interesting to meet all the Dutch and the Flemish people and so on, and all the different nationalities one bumped into. That was quite stimulating, I think, too. But, of course, the language barrier is always a problem if you didn't speak the language. Does that answer your question? Yes. That's about all I had.
Yes, but when did you know, what area of Germany did you move into after Holland?
Yes. Across the Rhine into Clave, that's right, Clave, that was the one, which is my first baptism of what a town looked like when it's just been taken, and it looked a mess, and casualties on the way, of course.
It's crossing the Rhine, what was that like?
I'm not quite sure about it now. Was the Rhine crossed after Clave? I'm not sure by geography now, it's so distant.
Perhaps it's not to worry.
No.
It's just...
I can't remember.
I wonder if it was a big thing going over the Rhine.
Well, it was
considered.
It was. That was the great build-up. Was the endless pontoon bridge that ferried up convoys of lorries with pontoon little boats on them, really, which have then made up into pontoon bridges and very remarkable, exciting structures too. I think in many ways. So again, to a young man, they seem exciting. These big challenges of engineering and so on, which they did. It's quite remarkable what the army got through in those days when they got the wherewithal. And the hold-up was the Rhine for long enough. Now, I can't remember I think it must have been the other side of the Rhine. I think it must have crossed the Rhine, but I can't think how, whether it's by bridge or probably pontoon. And the first bit of Germany they took was Bedburg, and that was the first German soil they were on. And then I think Clave was the next. It's on the Weser, I think, isn't it? The River Weser. And we were brought up quite quickly to supposedly look after civilian casualties, which we didn't find many of. In fact, it wasn't our job, except to make sure that there were facilities for civilians, and that was done by supporting local hospitals or local nuns or whoever ran ambulance services or whatever it was there locally. So we were very much looking for a role, but didn't always find one if there weren't needs. But that was our remit, I think, to look to prop up essential medical services in the occupied area, or wherever it was, whether it was in Holland or Germany, particularly in Germany, where it was nobody's job officially because they were the enemy. So it was our job to fill that gap, I guess. And sometimes we did something, sometimes we didn't, depending on what the needs were. But there was a bit of mess there. I can't remember doing much there except surviving, as it were. And
did you get an impression, you know, of the German civilian population?
Well, they'd fled, in that clave, they'd all fled, as it were. I mean, they'd all pushed off, and we were in a house run by a dentist. He was no sign of him, he pushed off. But we did obviously come into contact with, when we went to the hospitals, the nuns were still there looking after the patients, and if there were nuns, it mostly tended to be run by the nuns, or people that looked like nuns to me anyway, whether they were nurses' uniform. And then, of course, dig out the medical personnel who were running them, and they were usually around. They'd hung on to the needy folk in the hospitals or thereabouts. And of course, the other chap you had to dig out was the mayor, the local mayor, who was always a key man to get anything done. There's usually somebody who'd stayed on as a mayor or take the rap to look after the remaining civilians.
And who was sort of finding your roles for you? Would this have been Gerald Gardner at this stage still?
I'm not quite clear about it. I wasn't section leader, so I don't know. The section leaders went up and got their remits from Gerald and the Red Cross, you see. It was really the Red Cross as much as anybody, I think. I don't know. I'm not conversant with what went on his headquarters, but I guess Gerald would be the sort of chap who would work in with the Red Cross and back them up and offer his particular group of semi-trained people to help where they could.
How big a group were you then?
It'd be about 10, 12, I think. It'd be about, yes, 10 or 12 in a group, I think it would be. Each section was about 10 or 12 people, I think.
And how many sections went in?
Oh, there were two already there who went in much earlier than we did. I don't know. Len Darling and his team went in. I think about August, September, 44. Section 1 and 2, and there's about another 6, I think, went with Gerald, I think. Each section of about 10 or 12 people. I'm not sure now. It seems silly not to be able to remember, but it was about that number. Each with a couple of ambulances and a small truck and a big three-tonner, I think it was. So we could carry supplies about. If the hospital wanted supplies, we could get them about, because the Germans had no transport, or certainly the refugees in Holland had no transport. We got the access to the petrol and the transport that would work. So if they wanted blankets or beds moved about, well, we could do it.
Were you working closely with the army at this stage?
No, not that I know of. I mean, obviously, we depended on the army for supplies, NAFI and so on, and rations, and also for accommodation. I mean, you couldn't stay anywhere unless you'd seen I've forgotten the chap's name, who runs the...
Would it be the quartermaster?
No, some other name. His job was, anywhere was occupied, he'd just carve up the place, so the general has the best, the major has the best place, and oh, the FAU apply somewhere, oh, we can have that one. And you go where you're told, and somebody's house usually. He'd reconnoitred and found empty or throw them out. One doesn't know, but there wasn't time to ask. You just went where you're told and set up there.
How about the anti-frat laws? Did you
those? Yes, they still applied, really, but, you know.
Did you observe them?
No. No. A lot of the army didn't, for that matter. It went further than that. The army did, went into tents and got on with the ladies. Some of the army did. No, I think it was a bit. I can see the point of it. I mean, they were very insecure of themselves, a lot of the army. They weren't sure how many booby traps were around and how many people they could trust. But I think officially they had to do that. But of course, as time went on, they needed to talk to Germans like we had to talk to the mayors. I mean, you can't be totally sealed lips, can you, in that situation? So, I think. But of course, lots of people didn't speak German, so that was another handicap. So conversation very limited for most people, anyway. Anyhow, from Clave, we went on to Kevelaar, which is the next bit further into Germany. I'm not sure quite where it is now. It seems very vague about my geography. Probably David mentioned that, didn't he, David Rudd? He's at Kevelaar. And I think we started looking after. Did we look after camps there? I think some refugee camps.
Did there seem to be a lot of refugees about?
Yes. Well, we didn't pick them up. I think the army picked them up in the sense that they, as they went through, they came across these groups of barracks and things, which are, you know, single-story huts, groups of huts everywhere, which are a mixture of. I suppose some must have been prisoners of war, or most of them were workers from foreign countries, I think. There was a concentration camp in Holland, I think we visited once.
Did you?
In the other days.
Yes.
Well, see, the word concentration camp has got emotive terms. It was really just a transit camp, which was well run, but the press would call it a concentration camp. But it's very good hospital facilities and all sorts of things. There is a transit camp, I suppose, for Dutch or people to be exported to work in Germany. And people were, I suppose, I'm not defending the Germans because they did some awful things, but it was called then a concentration camp. But it was really a sort of a superior hostel accommodation. This is the FAU had in London for people going through and doing things, you know.
As you say, there are emotive overtones, aren't there, to the word. But did you find there was a great variation in the sort of nature of these camps?
Oh, yes. Some were very primitive, yes. Oh, yes. And, of course, they got more primitive because they'd been overcrowded for so long and the war aggravated it, no doubt. And, of course, with women and children there, a lot of them got their wives there and girlfriends and children and so on. It wasn't easy. I mean, you can't. Family life in a group like this is not easy, is it? So that, yes, they were in need of looking after somebody taking over and seeing they got supplied with food and so on, because the whole system had broken down, obviously, in the war. As the armies go through, the army comes first, and any retreating army takes what it can. It feeds itself first before it bothers about the camps. So that we, I think, got information about these from the army, I think. Military government, I suppose, would give us the information. And then we'd follow these up and try and get them in some sort of sanitary and healthy condition, seeing they got supplied with food and bedding and sorted out some of their problems, whether they want gather numbers, what the numbers were and what they were from, what nationality they were and so on, with a view to eventually, you know, dispersing them, I suppose. But then we were very transient. We would tend to move on with the army again. So in Kevelaar, we moved on, and somebody else, another FAU group, came in and took over our job. So it wasn't much continuity in that sense, but it was very much firefighting, you know, just to get the fire out and move on.
So So how far in did you go into Germany when you moved from that area?
Tegel.
Would this be where you came to the prisoners of war and the had the contact with the Russians? Was it Oldenburg?
Oh, we got into Oldenburg, yes. That was the last big... Yes, that was, again, it was camps again. It was a lot of prisoners of war. Or all nationalities, French, German, Russian, Poles. Again, it was a camp support system that we ran. I mean, we had the transport to get to the various camps and check with the local mayor. We had the authority to... The mayor wouldn't do anything for them, but he would do it if we said so, because we at least had the backing of the military government, I suppose. So they jumped, as it were. So in a sense, we leaned on the Englishness of ourselves and the fact that it was an occupying army. But they were very, you know, on the whole, they were very cooperative, and he wanted palliasses, 1,000 palliasses, you know. He would produce them, or seem to. And
What were these camps like? Could you give us some idea of the conditions the inmates were living under?
Well, it'd be something like a series of army huts. You know what army huts look like, about, oh, I suppose, 40, 50 feet long, about 20 feet wide, and a stove in the middle, usually, one of these old-fashioned stoves, and some latrines somewhere, and a cookhouse somewhere, with great pots, often empty, but wanting filling up with food. The Russians would have their own 3 or 4 huts, and Poles over the lot, and a few French perhaps, and whoever was, they'd separate themselves in nationalities.
Were there differences, you know, between the nationalities? Were some more easy to deal with?
Oh, yes, others? Yes. Oddly enough, I was very impressed with the Russians, because they were highly organised. A very wise old chap it was in those days, probably about 45, in charge, who anything asked him to do, we'd like, try and get that mended with you, you know, it would be done, no bother. But one got the impression that there was an elite of people who were educated and knew what they're doing, and the rest were simple peasants who did as they're told and very orderly. And without the stiffening of the upper crust, they would have been very peasanty, but very pleasant. No bother out of them. The French were the obstreperous ones who, we're French, we're not going to make our own palliasses or do anything, you know, we're French. And insisted on being repatriated, and we got rid of them very quickly. There weren't many of them, but that was the attitude, the total difference of attitude. The Russians accepted that things took time. You couldn't get back to Russia tomorrow. And, you know, meanwhile, we'd just get on and do our own thing, but the French... Oh, no, we're not doing any of those sort of menial jobs. So that sort of highlighted some of the differences, and the Poles were a mixture like any other race.
These would have been sort of prisoners of war, would they, straightforward?
I think so. I never quite worked out what they were. I'm not sure whether they were... Some were displaced persons. In those fluid times, if a person had no home and he found some of the friendly... Russians, or albeit his own compatriots, who probably joined them. I think a lot were probably workers, more than prisoners of war, I think. All right.